Hi, this is Yaron Brook, and you might have heard I am joining Dr. Peikoff's podcast, and I will be covering topics different from what Dr. Peikoff is doing. I'll be covering issues related to economics, politics, current events, foreign policy. So issues related to the state of our political world, issues related to the morality of capitalism, the morality of aspects of our economy, the morality of aspects of our foreign policy. So definitely grounded in morality in the objectivist philosophy, but focused on these more current event type issues. I will not, however, talk about specific candidates, specific laws, since I am the CEO of a 501c3. I'm not allowed to legally. Finally, if you want to get more information about me and about the work that I do, go to aynrand.org, aynrand.org, or follow me on Twitter, Yaron Brook, YaronBrook, or on Facebook. Thank you all for listening. Okay, so let's start with the questions. And the first question is asking about monopolies. So he says, if an individual acquires a monopoly in business, such as utilities or telecom, isn't that monopoly much the same as collectivism, and therefore preventing others from enjoying the opportunities that a free society offers? Or am I misunderstanding the terms? Well, it is the latter, unfortunately. There's no relationship here between monopoly and collectivism or controlling an industry. Or, you know, we can talk about what monopoly is in a minute, but let's first talk about what is collectivism. Collectivism is not getting what you want or not getting what you want at the price that you want. Collectivism means that the unit of value is the group, that your life as an individual doesn't matter except in that you serve the group. So you're a cog in some machine. The machine is the tribe, the country, your ethnic group. It's something beyond you. It involves other people, and as that, your life is insignificant. So when we talk about political systems that are collectivist political systems, we talk about statism, where the government is basically willing to sacrifice the individual for so-called society, for some group, whether that group is a minority, whether that group is the poor, whether that group is the middle class. It doesn't matter. You as an individual don't matter. What matters is what group you belong to, what group you're being sacrificed to, or what group is sacrificing to you. It's all about viewing individuals as cogs and machines. And statism is the broad term, but socialism, communism, and the mixed economy we have today are all forms of collectivism. They're all forms of collectivistic political systems. Now, what about monopolies? Monopolies, I don't believe monopolies exist in a free market. Monopoly is when one individual or one company controls a segment of an industry. But the fact is that under freedom, in a true laissez-faire free market, laissez-faire capitalism, there's always competition. Somebody could always arise out of nowhere and compete you out of business. Somebody could always challenge your dominance. There are no legal barriers to entry, and therefore anybody can challenge you if you don't provide the kind of quality service at the kind of prices that are going to satisfy your customers and or that somebody else can come in and undercut you at. So there are no real examples of monopolies in a true free market. The only type of monopolies we actually see are government-sponsored monopolies, where the government creates barriers to entry, legal barriers to entry, so that competitors can't come and intervene. So, you know, today, the obvious example of that is the post office. The post office, you try delivering first-class mail across the country, you go to jail if you do that. So the post office has a legal monopoly, and that's awful. But if it's not granted by the government, it's not really a monopoly. And I'll end with this last example. The best example of what people call a monopoly is Rockefeller, Standard Oil, in the late 19th century. Rockefeller had over 90% of all oil refining in the United States. And prices went down every year. And quality went up. It's exact opposite of what your econ professors teach you, right? They teach you that if you have a so-called monopoly, you won't care about your customers. Your prices will go up and quality will go down, right? You'll price it high because people don't have any option but to buy from you. Why did Rockefeller always lower prices? And this is an empirical fact. Well, he lowered prices because he knew that if he didn't, somebody, some competitor, will come around and take business from him. He also knew that there were alternatives to oil. At the time, oil was being used for lighting. There were alternatives for oil, and he had to make sure that he priced kerosene, which is the product after the refining, cheaper than all those alternatives for oil, and the prices started going up, other alternatives would appear. And indeed, what drove Rockefeller out of business? What drove Rockefeller out of the lighting business. Well, there was a competitor nobody could have imagined. Certainly not no government bureaucrat at some regulatory agency that was supposed to oversee lighting, the lighting czar, right? What really competed Rockefeller out of the lighting business was Thomas Edison, was electricity, was something coming out of nowhere. And this is exactly the nature of a free market. You never know who your competitors are going to be. Next question. This is a depressing one. So the question is, what would be the likely effect of a major economic collapse far beyond the severity of the 2008 crisis, either, you know, during the Romney-Obama presidency? Now, let me just say, I don't think it's a certainty that there will be a major economic collapse during the next administration, whoever wins the election. We're taping this just before the election, so I'm not sure who's won. Peter Schiff, a well-known commentator on economic issues and who's a very good economic thinker, is pretty convinced that an economic collapse is imminent. I don't agree with him necessarily. I think that if nothing changes, some kind of major economic crisis is on the horizon, but how far that horizon is, I don't know. It could be next year. It could be 10 years from now. It'll look bad. It could look very, very bad. The mistakes that the Federal Reserve and our federal government have been making economically have been getting worse and worse. They've been compounding errors. So every time they try to solve a crisis, they make it worse and they set up the next crisis to be much, much bigger than the previous crises. So the errors are being compounded on top of one another. But how that exactly manifests itself? It could, for example, manifest itself in hyperinflation, where you see a complete collapse of the U.S. dollar, prices going through the roof, people having to adjust prices on a daily basis, people running to buy fixed goods, goods that actually maintain their value or decrease in value very little as compared to consumables, for example. People trying not to hold cash. We saw such hyperinflation periods many times in human history, or at least in modern history. We saw it in South America in the 1980s. I lived in Israel when there was 1,500% inflation. We saw it in Germany before World War II. Nothing good comes out of this. Of course, there are various outcomes of this. We saw what happened in Germany after the hyperinflation. We saw the rise of fascism. On the other hand, in Latin America, many of the more pro-market reforms occurred in attempts to fix the economy post-hyperinflation. So you could see hyperinflation. But you could also see massive credit deflation in a sense of a contraction of credit, a contraction of money, and people defaulting on their debt left and right, a massive contraction in actual economic activity. And as a consequence, just unemployment going through the roof. By the way, you could see the unemployment go through the roof with inflation. And here I mean by inflation, I mean price inflation, prices going up, which of course is a symptom of actual inflation, which is the printing of the money. Look, it's going to look ugly. It means people out of work. It means standard of living declining. It means potentially riots in the street. Look at Greece. Look at what's going on in Greece. It means cutting government, which means cutting entitlements to people. And it'll be interesting to see how those people react when those entitlements are cut. It means the private sector increased both uncertainty, but also just increased problems for them. Now, it also all depends on how government responds. Now, there's no reason to believe that it'll respond well by cutting spending, by cutting regulation, and ultimately by cutting taxes. So when we hit the next crisis, I fear it's going to be a lot worse than 2008. It's going to have a real profound impact on the standard of living of Americans, and it's going to be very difficult to get out of because the ideas that shape economic policy have not changed enough to secure that next crisis we respond better than we did in the 2008 crisis. So this one is about the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, which is taking on Google. It's taking it to court because of a long list of companies have been complaining to the FTC, arguing that the agency should crack down on Google. This relates to the issue of monopolies. The idea is that Google is a monopolist and it's engaged in unfair trade practices, and therefore the government needs to step in to protect competition. And the questioner goes on, this sounds like competitors found a way to get their competition. And yes, this is an example of cronyism. This is an example of cronyism created by the antitrust laws and by the various evolutions of antitrust over the last 100. Antitrust was passed in 1890, so over the last 122 years. Antitrust is one of the most immoral, illegitimate laws on the books today in America, or the books of the last 120 years in America. It basically is a non-objective law that penalizes business, or can penalize business, for pretty much anything that they do. If you sell your product really, really cheap, then you must be dumping, and you must be trying to drive your competitors out of business and taking market share from them, and therefore that's bad. So the Justice Department went after Microsoft in the 1990s for selling Internet Explorer at the unbelievable price of $0 for nothing, giving it away for free. That was viewed as a violation of antitrust. And in those days, it was also Microsoft's competitors that went to the FTC and the Justice Department to get them to take action against Microsoft. In those days, it was Netscape and others who did this. So yes, this opens it up to cronyism, because you see a competitor doing something wrong, and wait a minute, I can shut them down. I can force them to change their behavior. And it's very tempting for what I consider weak, immoral, unprincipled CEOs to use government as a competitive tool in their favor by going after their competition using antitrust. So, for example, if prices are very high, I don't even know what very high is, but I guess high relative to history, then the Justice Department can go after you for collusion, because how come prices are high? You must be, all the people in the industry must be talking to one another and colluding in order to make prices high. It's really fascinating to talk to people who attend like conferences, industry conferences, and the ability to talk to one another is very restricted. They have to be very, very careful, because they might be colluding, so people are watching out. So if you price your product below your competitors, you're dumping. If you price it above your competitors and you still got market share, something's wrong there. So no matter what you do, you're somehow in violation. If you price your product exactly the same as all your competitors, that's collusion. There's just no way to get around antitrust. Antitrust is a law that the government can go after you almost under any circumstances. And now it's a question of when are they incentivized to do it. And one of the strong incentives is to do it, just like here in the case of Google, when you're lobbied to do it. When Google's competitors, somebody else's competitors, pay money to politicians or to lobbyist firms in order to go after Google. This is completely unjust. Let the market play out. Let people gain whatever market share they have. Let them price whatever it needs to be. Let the market actually work. Let freedom, let free markets work. One of the first things that I think should be repealed, if we had a decent Congress, a decent president, would be antitrust laws. Antitrust is one of the greatest impediments to true competition in the world. It does the exact opposite of what was meant to be. It was meant to increase competition. It actually decreases competition, destroys competition by penalizing the best competitors. So those of you who listened to the joint podcast Dr. Peikoff and I did a few weeks ago, where we talked about libertarianism, at the end of that podcast, we kind of challenged everybody to come up with a better word than capitalism for the objectivist political philosophy. And many of you have written in and made suggestions. But on thinking about this, I think both Dr. Peikoff and I have come to the conclusion that that was just wrong of us. We don't need a new word. What we need is to define the concept and then defend the concept that we have already. Capitalism is a fine word to describe political freedom. It is a fine concept. We have a clear definition, Ayn Rand's definition of capitalism. We know what it means. We know what ideas it represents, and those ideas are true and right. It is also true that in the culture, capitalism is understood to mean economic freedom. It is understood to mean free markets. Now, many people understand capitalism as the mixed economy, but they understand that capitalism is that part of the mixed economy that is free. So there's a good basis there for us to build on. There's a good understanding from which for us to now defend the concept in its pure laissez-faire capitalism sense. So I think the political philosophy of objectivists is capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism. We are, as Ayn Rand described it and as Leonard Peikoff has described it, we are radicals for capitalism. That is our political identity. That is our political philosophy. As we said, it is not libertarianism, which we've talked about. It is not, it's not really anything else. There is no other term. We are defenders of individualism, but individualism is a more of an ethical term. We are defenders of individual rights, but it's not easy to turn individual rights into kind of an ism, ideology. Capitalism is the word that captures all that. Capitalism is about individual rights. It's about the defense of individual rights, in particular property rights, in which all property is privately owned. That's the capitalism is a system of a complete separation between state and economics, and therefore is a system of freedom, of free markets, of freedom from coercion, primarily, you know, in a system that protects you primarily from coercion from government, which is the most coercive elements. Now, many of you had some pretty creative words, but on looking on them, I mean, none of them works. None of them captures actually what we need to capture. And again, looking back and looking at Ayn Rand's definition, looking at Ayn Rand's, the way she's used it and all the work we've all done, but particularly that Rand did in order to defend capitalism and to present capitalism, capitalism not known ideal, of course, I think that's the term we should stick to, that's the term we should embrace, that's the term we should fight for, and that's the term we should present a moral and economic defense of. So while I appreciate all your suggestions, I'm going to have to call off this competition, and let's all recommit ourselves to being radicals for capitalism.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.